the great, many great tragedies of this Iraq fiasco is that nobody in a responsible position thought very hard at all about how to define victory before it began. And even today, I would say, there is no agreed definition of what that would mean.
One of our members of the roundtable for this afternoon, Stephen Myers, was notified day before yesterday of his ability to have a very important interview at the White House at this time. And I questioned his priorities, but finally we agreed to give him an unconditional release from the obligation to attend here today. So we have two really outstanding participants in this round table. And I thought what we'd do is this. I will give the briefest of introduction because there's plenty of material in the little brochure about the background of these two gentlemen. We will do a little discussion here at the table. I've prepared a few questions to sort of kick off the conversation. And then after about 30 or 40 minutes of discussion here, we have a standing microphone at the back. And I would ask those who would like to ask a question of either of the two participants to go to the back of the room when the Q&A period starts and ask your question. I'm sure everybody in the room can hear you anyway, but we are recording this for posterity, so that's why we'd like you to use the microphone. On my left, on your right, is Robert Kaiser, who is the associate editor of the Washington Post. He served as a foreign correspondent in Vietnam and in Moscow, and he is the author of six books. On my right, on your left, is Bernard Kalb. Bernie is a veteran journalist, media critic, author. He has been reported for CBS, for NBC, for the New York Times. He started the show and was the rock of the CNN program Reliable Source for many years. And he is very experienced at this kind of thing. And when I told him of some of the questions I thought I would answer, he said, "Look, you're the moderator. You can do whatever you want, but those are really dumb questions." It is not the first time that he has been felt the need to unburden himself and be very candid. In 1985, he was serving as the spokesman for the State Department. George Shultz was the Secretary of State at that time under President Reagan. And Bernie Kalb got word that the Secretary of State had approved a public disinformation campaign against Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And he disagreed with the State Department doing a program like that and went to talk to the Secretary of State. And he agreed that the Secretary of State certainly had the right to do that, but he thought it was a bad idea and that he was going to have to resign as a protest. Here's what Time magazine wrote about that episode. "Standing in his familiar position on the podium of the State Department press room, Bernard Kalb announced to stunned reporters that he chose to, quote, dissent from the reported disinformation program. Said Kalb, a former correspondent for NBC and CBS, quote, you face a choice as an American, as a spokesman, as a journalist, whether to allow oneself to be absorbed in the ranks of silence, whether to vanish into unopposed acquiescence, or to enter a modest dissent. He added, faith in the word of America is the pulse beat of our democracy. So it's a great pleasure to have somebody who is a rock of personal integrity with us, and I hope that his comments, except on the quality of the questions, will be unbridled. Mr. Kaiser wrote on January 14, 2007, in the Post as follows. For the United States, Iraq has become another Vietnam. Fortunately, the overall death toll in Iraq so far, while high, is still smaller than it was in Vietnam. But tragically, the most important difference between the two conflicts may be that defeat in Iraq is likely to produce catastrophic consequences for that nation, its neighbors, and the United States. So I would like to ask Mr. Kaiser to start the conversation by addressing what do we now mean by defeat, how would we define success, and what do we see as the, quote, catastrophic consequences for Iraq, the Middle East, and the United States if we settle for something other than what we've defined as success?
Thank you very much. One of the problems of the internet age is that your past words really never disappear. I realize, listening to you, reading me, that I'm a little less gloomy probably than I was when I wrote that. But let me not start with there. Let me start with the problem of defining victory. As I'm sure has come up in the course of this conference, and for anybody who's thought about wars the United States has been involved in general, it's never easy to define victory unless you take the kind of FDR World War II approach that victory just means the total destruction of our enemies. But you know, in fact, in the history of wars, to have two major military powers like Germany and Japan simply cry uncle and give up at the end is essentially unique. This doesn't happen very often. I think it's one of our problems in the post-World War II era is that we've always had a difficult time defining what a victory would be. I think we could spend the afternoon making a pretty good case that in many respects we had a kind of a weird victory in Vietnam in the context of all the consequences that flowed from the war. I'm not going to try to make that argument now. But I will suggest that one of the many great tragedies of this Iraq fiasco is that nobody in a responsible position thought very hard at all about how to define victory before it began. And even today, I would say, there is no agreed definition of what that would mean. If we had an enemy, even an enemy as clearly recognizable as the Communist Party of Vietnam and the government in Hanoi that we had in the Vietnam War in Iraq, then we could have a much easier time saying what beating that enemy would be. But who's the enemy in Iraq? I don't know. I still don't know. I find it intriguing. Bernie's history from 85 is a reminder of how governments love to oversimplify and propagandize. So we have had right from the beginning, and this new report issued yesterday by the Senate Intelligence Committee is a powerful reminder of it, we've had from the beginning in Iraq an attempt to make Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization the enemy in Iraq. It was a phony argument in the beginning, and it's still a phony argument now. And the fact that this crazy Jordanian named his group al-Qaeda in Iraq has been a great blessing to American propagandists of all kinds, but it's got nothing to do with reality. It's not as though anybody who calls themselves al-Qaeda in Iraq has ever met Osama bin Laden or has anything to do with that organization that's now sort of headquartered in the troublesome provinces of Pakistan. So we can talk more about this if it's interesting, but I think this is a huge problem for the United States strategically now, is not being able to say what it is, who we're fighting, and what it is we're trying to accomplish. Here is the argument of this piece that George has read a little bit of. I will just briefly repeat here, because I think it's still the heart of the matter. To have a happy ending in Iraq, leaving aside the question of how to define a victory, but just a happy ending, which I would define as a relatively stable nation state in the boundaries of what we think of as Iraq, getting down to business of producing oil to feed our oil addiction in this country and others, that you know isn't a threat to its neighbors and isn't inherently unstable, would be a great outcome, be a big victory in a general sense, a vague use of the term. But getting there from here would depend on, will depend on, or would depend on, actors in the game doing things that they may or may not decide to do, but they are actors who we can't control and never could. And what we've tried to set up here is a situation that where we get what we're looking for, when in fact the only actors who can give us what we're looking for aren't sharing all of our interests and desires and see the world in a very different way than we do. What we need, I think, is some accepted definition of a country called Iraq, which will be accepted by Sunnis and Shia and Kurds, and allow all of them to participate in some kind of a body politic that functions and works, and which creates some kind of stability in that geographical territory. You know, now are these characters who you've all been introduced to on television and in the newspapers, with odd names and funny-looking outfits and faces, are they going to get together on something like this? I have the slightest idea. I'm very frustrated, I confess, with the journalism. And when Bernie and I were in Vietnam, we could go in South Vietnam, we could go everywhere, meet everybody, talk to local politicians, national politicians, all the relevant Americans. It was easy to get around. Our colleagues in Iraq now can't do that. And we do not have any good sense of Iraqi society. I mean, what's really going on in Kurdistan? There's a huge attempt by the Kurds to expel the Arab Iraqis that Saddam Hussein tried to move into Kurdistan to make a kind of ethnic claim to some of the oil wealth there. What's happening on the ground? We don't even know. I just find it very frustrating. So in any case, here we are, hoping to get out of Iraq. I'm certain we're on the way to getting out of Iraq, because I'm certain that the democratic body politic of this country just isn't going to put up with it much longer. But to get a happy ending, people have to do things that, for their own reasons, that happen to coincide with our best interests. Will that happen? Well, I'm not going to bet any of my money on it. But I'm not going to say it can't happen either, because, I mean, perhaps the happiest single fact of this horrible situation is that all the human beings who live in Iraq, with a very small number of exceptions, share an interest in having a society in which people don't think they might not survive through today or tomorrow. Stability, relative peace, an opportunity to make a living, all these basic human instincts, if acted on, will serve our broad interests. They will create a situation that will be tolerable. But I have no idea if we can get there from here.
What? it's troubling that if we don't know where we're going, we don't know whether we've gotten there or not, as Yogi Berra might have said. What were the catastrophic consequences that you've referred to in that piece?
Well, I was a victim there, and maybe should be still, of the conventional wisdom that the Iraqis are simply incapable of restraining themselves from conducting a vicious civil war that will, result in both chaos and a great deal of death and destruction. And maybe they are. I don't feel I have any sense of how crazy the Iraqis really are, how self-destructive they are capable of being. Someone said in the last session that ethnic cleansing, as the general said, that ethnic cleansing is pretty much over because you can't carry on ethnic cleansing forever. Well, this is correct. And certainly the ethnic distribution of the Iraqi population has been radically altered since the war began, and it's in a pattern now that is more stable, at least theoretically, than it was before. But no, I think you've asked a very good question. I can't really answer it.
Bernie, you were on the ground in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and you've been a intelligent observer of what's going on.
That's debatable.
We're going to concede that.
Yes. Just kidding.
What do you see as the difficult political decisions today, and how do they differ from the decisions that Johnson and Nixon confronted?
Well, I was expecting a different question, and I will answer mine. George, you made the mistake of showing me that piece of paper, and I was all geared up for that question. But
you told me it was a dumb question.
That's quite true, and I haven't changed my opinion, so I'll move it along at a different altitude, for example. Bob reminding us that we had knocked around in Vietnam all those years ago, and I made the mistake yesterday of a chronological blunder of saying that the first time I had visited Vietnam was before anyone in this room was even born, which was 1956. But three dates come to my mind right now, because one of the questions that you had jotted down that you didn't have the courage to ask me was, as a former spokesman, what would you tell the incoming president?
No, I'm saving that question.
You're saving that. Well, there's a presumption, because no president has ever listened to a spokesman before. We take that for granted. But I'm thinking we're talking essentially about the politics of withdrawal. And so three vignettes come to my mind about being on the ground in Vietnam over several decades. The first, 1973, I am at Clark Air Base outside of Manila in the Philippines, reporting on the arrival of the first prisoners coming back after years in Hanoi. That first big plane that arrived, and they came out, they walked down the ramp, some were injured, some were on crutches. I don't know whether John McCain was in that very first of newly returned POWs, but there, scratched into my mind, of course, when we think about how to disengage from Iraq, is that very vivid image of the POWs coming back from Hanoi as a result of the agreement that was signed in January 73 between the United States and North Vietnam. The second image is 10 years later. It's 1973. I am now in Saigon. And that was the night, as Chester reminded me earlier, he's working on a book on the television war, that was the day, September 1973, when CBS, for whom I was working then, my first visit to Vietnam was as a New York Times correspondent. But now I was at CBS in 1973, and I was in Vietnam the day CBS went from 15-minute program to a 30-minute program. 1963, that's right. And 1963, I'm thinking, for example, I was on the ground at Tansanoot Airport when Henry Cabot Lodge arrived. And for that first broadcast, for that very first broadcast, somehow I managed to get Henry Cabot Lodge to walk down with me along Tuzo Street, the main street of Saigon, talking about what he thought the challenge of his new ambassadorial assignment would be. I haven't the slightest recollection of what he said, but it is clear that his grasp of the story, how shall I put it generously, his grasp of the story lacked the cultural penetration that was required for somebody on the ground representing the United States. Because what comes back to me is a phrase he used in a message when LBJ in 64 or so cabled Lodge and asked him what he thought the results would be in Hanoi if the United States introduced heavy bombing of the North. I think I've got the cable right in my mind, a declassified cable. And I see some of the scholars are nodding their heads. They know what I'm about to say. And Henry Cabot Lodge said that he was all for the bombing. And he thought the bombing would, quote, scare Hanoi, unquote, blah, 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 and, quote, in two words that so extraordinarily italicized the depths of American ignorance, if they were personified by Henry Cabot Lodge at that moment, he thought the bombing would, quote, frighten Ho. Now, those of us who have had any relationship with Vietnam recognize the depth of the ludicrosity of frightening Ho. Frightening Ho. Frightening Ho Chi Minh, the unfrightenable Ho Chi Minh, that bombing would scare Hanoi and frighten Ho, I leave that for you to digest. And now, just early this year, again, I'm back in Vietnam, where I find myself going constantly. I have this deal with Vietnam. I don't let go of Vietnam, and Vietnam doesn't let go of me. It works. It's a fine deal, and I like it. I stay with my wife 2 weeks at a time in Hanoi, 3 weeks at a time in Hanoi. And this last time, curiously, we found ourselves on Tet. We all remember Tet 1968, the VC, the NVA on the embassy grounds, et cetera. And when General Westmoreland on the embassy grounds that day was asked, what do you think was the strategy of the enemy right here? And he came up with a phrase that is so American that it too should go there with fright and hoe. Their objective was to create, quote, maximum consternation. The strategy of Hanoi, create maximum consternation. In any case, so there we are in Tet this past February, downtown Saigon. Crowds are extraordinary crowds. I see my old hotel, the Caravelle Hotel. There used to be a huge statue of a South Vietnamese warrior. Remember that, Bob? That's down. There was a rock band performing there. But the thing about it all was, in this great crowd, celebrating their ration freedom, celebrating their endeavors now at free enterprise of various intensities, small and huge, around town, there was a reminder put up by the party, hammers and sickles, little 8x10s of hammers and sickles put on trees, as though reminding the masses, hey, hammer and sickle is a communist outfit running this operation. So I have these various plus hundreds of other images that stalk my mind about Vietnam. And of course, the priority now is disengagement from Iraq. At lunch, Bob asked me, was it you? Yes, it had to be him, all penetrating questions. The question came up in one way or another, the preference of Vietnam, which of the candidates does Hanoi prefer? And when I was in Hanoi for 2 weeks, I still have a scrap of journalistic curiosity about me, I asked that question to everybody I could meet. Who's your favorite candidate? There were three then, McCain, Obama, Senator Clinton. The answers invariably, I put this question to a member of the foreign ministry, all on background, on no attribution, no names, and I'm not using any now, and just people, friends of mine, people who had covered the war of Vietnamese I've known for years. Who's the favorite candidate? What do you think? McCain. Anybody else?
Clinton.
Clinton? Obama. You're right. Only McCain. I heard no other preference. I heard only McCain. Let's say my scientific polling consisted, say, of about 30 Vietnamese. Only McCain. And so I said, McCain? And then I think I was just yesterday had driven by the lake that McCain had been fetched out of in 1995. I had just a day or two before gone through the prison where McCain had been and see the picture of him. And we were taken on a tour of the prison by no less a personality than a survivor of the prison, Pete Peterson, one of the pilots who was shot down. I think Pete Peterson was there. How long was he in that prison?
6 or 7 years.
Yeah, a long time. Later became
first ambassador to Vietnam.
Yeah, later became the first ambassador to Vietnam. And Pete Peterson was giving a tour to a group of young CEOs of what the prison was like in his day. And he was very candid. What was it like? How did we speak, communicate with each other? What were the pressures? What were the tortures? They had a name, names, yes, Frank Sinatra, here's a name for you. How did you talk to each other? We try to communicate with metal teacups through the wall, and we talk very slowly to stretch out the calendar as long as we could. I memorized, what was that number, Phyllis?
267.
I memorized the names of 267 prisoners. American prisoners in this jail, just around the corner from the Hilton Hotel, in this jail, so that after the war, if questions came up about who might be there, who has disappeared, we're still MIA on some of the people, I have 267. And he said, we all memorize names. Reminds me of that movie Fahrenheit 451, reciting Shakespeare in a society where all literature was expunged and so forth. So I have these impressions, and I think of all the years I was in and out of Vietnam and what it came to at the end. And when I see the hammer and sickle, the nudge of a reminder by the parties to tell the masses, who's running, yeah, we're still here, as they're going about their business in the ration freedom way, as I call it, what did that come to? And what will this come to? And so, I'm not a whiz at this subject. I've been listening to scholars for 2 days with Jeff Record has just done this long piece this morning with the general on how you disengage, what the terms are, et cetera, et cetera. And as Kaiser has just indicated, the complexity of predicting on this particular question. But there's no doubt that there will be a disengagement. I think, for example, about when I think particularly about words, three words that always come to my mind about Vietnam, it's arrogance, ignorance, and panic. Panic because, pardon me, as we were confronting the Soviets in Europe, the United States said, that's a bad call, confronting the Soviets in Europe. Let's get this raggedy little third-rate country, unquote, was the phrase, off in Vietnam. That's easy, peasants. There'll be no problem. We'll stop the communists there. And I used to sit in my room, 206 at the Caravelle Hotel, and have Armed Forces radio on. I'd listen to LBJ. This is under the heading of Logic Doesn't Travel. I'd listen to LBJ calling in the, how many governments were there after the overthrow of Diem? Six or seven? Who's the scholar here? Seven different governments until 67 when Chu came in. Government every other week. And LBJ, as I heard him on the Armed Forces radio, would say, why can't the Vietnamese put their political differences aside and form a political unity to face the common enemy? I used to double up with laughter in my room because it was so out of touch with the political reality on the ground in Vietnam. And in Bob's piece, which I read this morning, talking again about the ignorance with which the United States moved in and the inconceivability of Nixon, LBJ, President Bush, the inconceivability that there are limits to American military power. That is an unnamed Secretary of State. When my brother was covering the State Department, used to exhibit on a Friday afternoon when he brought up the regular press corps people. When the United States, unquote, quote, presses its finger down hard, meaning militarily, the United States gets the results it wants. Didn't happen in Vietnam. Doesn't look like it's happening here. And this different enemy in Iraq represents a different kind of challenge. There seems to be, the debate seems to be over now about the need for disengagement. It's the how the disengagement will take place. And if you recall, as some of the scholars did this morning, about the letter that Nixon gave to Chu to reassure him, as the Vietnamese felt they were being betrayed, the South, by the United States, to reassure him that if the nasty Hanoi misbehaved, the U.S. would come to the rescue again. But of course, Watergate grounded all the B-52s, and then before you know it, it was all over.
One of the problems, Bernie, that you remind us of is South Vietnam was a creation. It had no ethnic or geographic legitimacy. It was created by the Geneva Peace Agreements in 1954. And the Vietnamese understood this always. We were more foreigners. We were the successors to the French. If you go back to Vietnam now, as we've both done, it's all one long war in Vietnamese memory. There was the French phase, there was the American phase, and then we took over our own country. We took it back. That's how the Vietnamese always thought of it. We always had a certain number of collaborators who would work with us, but they were never a legitimate political presence in the South, and they were never accepted. They were always seen to be an appendage of us. I think we have a similar problem in Iraq, and it is astounding, really, to think how few Americans, even today, understand what a false creation Iraq was. This was a creation of the British Foreign Office.
You want to take a pencil and show how Churchill drew this? Churchill took a piece of paper, put a diagram so
this will be Iraq.
Goes and said, this will be Iraq.
And, you know, I mean, why is there all this ethnic controversy and combat in Iraq? It's because the Kurds think of themselves first as Kurds, the Shia think of themselves first as Shia, the Sunnis think of themselves as the local aristocracy that ought to be in charge, and the idea of an Iraqi nation to which all three groups hold a primary loyalty remains to this day a foreign idea. And yet the success of our enterprise depends entirely on enough people getting together around the idea of an Iraqi nation to make one work. It's really quite remarkable that we've done this twice in our brief lifetimes.
But go ahead.
I would like to ask you sort of a two-part question based on issues that George Packer has raised in some of his reporting. The first is the betrayed issue. How much damage have we done by failing to provide any road out for those who have helped the Americans?
In Iraq.
And the sort of second part of that is the apparent flight in wholesale numbers of the educated professional classes. Can a stable government be created in the absence of the educated professional classes?
The betrayal argument, there's an interesting Vietnamese parallel. One of the noblest, finest things that Henry Kissinger did, in my experience, was put on airplanes, two or three big 707s, to take the employees of American news organizations out of Saigon in 1975. Vu Thuy Hoang was the wonderful Vietnamese journalist who worked for the Washington Post for 10, 12 years, who is now the patriarch of a fabulous Vietnamese-American family whose children and grandchildren are spread across the land, doing wonderfully, a huge contribution to our society, and part of a very large group, not as large as it might have been at the time, but it's still a very large group of Vietnamese who had cast their lots with Americans who did get out, often with the generosity of American church groups and others that sponsored them when they came here, but importantly, initially, with the support of the United States government, which helped fly them out. And our record on refugees from Iraq, and particularly refugees of the people that signed up with us initially and were translators for the army and helped out with the American embassy and so on, is just tragically awful. We've just been totally irresponsible in abandoning these people. And it really is a black mark on our national reputation, in my opinion. So I think that's a very valid criticism. You know, one of the interesting things, I'm sure it's my Vietnam experience that made me do this, but I was the managing editor of the Post at the time of the first Gulf War, and walked around the newsroom in 1990-91 saying, what's Iraqi society like? What's, you know, who matters there? Who are the influential groups? What's the ethnic situation? Nobody at the Washington Post knew anything. We finally got some, found some experts, started to write some stories. But in fact, that Iraq of 1990, approximately, was a very cosmopolitan culture and totally secular, which was, for the intellectual class, the intelligentsia of Iraq, a great blessing, because they were really spared the usual Arab world problems of listening to mullahs and having the religious rules and regulations governing their lives. And the middle class in Saddam Hussein's Iraq was the most thriving secular middle class, I think, in the Arab world at that time. And those people who we did write about in 1990-91, they're not there anymore. The number of medical doctors in Iraq, Iraqi medical doctors, is now tiny, and something like 14,000, I can't remember the number, but a huge number of medical doctors are now all over the world, some in this country and other places. But Iraq has a terrible shortage of MDs, and so on. I mean, anybody who could afford to leave has left from the previous intellectual and business elite of what's always been a very screwed up society. But I think, you know, the building blocks for the creation of a functioning state called Iraq within these borders are pretty weak. It's why I've always been at least tempted by the Joe Biden argument that we just have to have a radical decentralization and work on developing three Iraqs.
You know, Bob, whatever the shape of the disengagement, America's stepping out of Iraq, you still have the entire ethnic gamble that this is all pivoted on, and that is to what degree the various groups in Iraq can get together. Now, we have seen, for example, that in the past few months there have been editorials. There's a strong editorial today about military progress in Iraq. There was, for me, a surprise editorial in the Washington Post this past Sunday, which said, indeed, there had been military progress, and we've got to take a second look at the idea of a hasty withdrawal. But whatever the parameters of the withdrawal, there is this central problem. It is built on an ethnic gamble as to whether the three major components can find a way to coexist. Now, the surge was designed in its original inception was to create a chunk of time on the calendar to see whether reconciliation might be possible. The diminution of hostility, antagonism sandpapered away, a recognition, for example, that all of us are stuck with this one Iraq and we've got to find a way to share the oxygen and live together. The consequences, the results were not very, very dramatic. They clung, most of the group still clung, to a separate demanding identity of their own. Now, I use the phrase ethnic gamble, on which the entire disengagement is predicated, because if there cannot be something approximating a reconciliation, a sense of responsibility to their own children, but as well to the future, that this is the way the deck has been dealt to us, and we've got to find a way to keep it together. I don't know whether you bet the farm on that. I don't know whether they would say, we'll take our chances with the future and we'll sort of push for our own interest and give them a paramount and priority place. I don't know that the possibility for coexistence exists. I would like to think like any rational human being, it does. But as I indicated before, my Vietnam experience is logic doesn't travel. What we think makes absolute rational sense in our world, where 2 and 2 add up to 4, other worlds, 2 and 2 are 11 or 16 or 19 or 2 or 3. Logic doesn't travel. And so what I'm talking about has at least the appearance of logic. Look, you've got this piece of land. You've been given a chance. You've gotten rid of the dictator. The United States has made great sacrifices, made a great contribution to create an opportunity for you. Use it. Take it. Will they? And there's the huge gamble. Now, that is to say, no matter how brilliant, and Jeff Record this morning made the point about the challenges that are shaped, and you have as well, no matter how brilliant, you're still left with that ethnic gamble, whether there will be a reaching out to each other so that they do, in fact, share some sort of common ethnic destiny.
If I may add, one of the great parallels between Vietnam and Iraq is that just as we denied the Vietnamese an opportunity to actually work things out for themselves, I think we've denied it to the Iraqis too. So if you're an Iraqi politician today, the question is, do I confront now the challenges that Bernie just described? Do I become one of the reconciling Kurds who want to make peace with the Shia and the Sunnis, or one of the reconciling Sunnis who wants to accept my new inferior status in a new Iraq, et cetera? What's the incentive to do that as long as we're still there running the show and making most of the big decisions? No incentive. And in fact, if there is a prospect of a successful disengagement, successful in the sense of creating a working, functioning Iraq, we're not going to know that until the Iraqis themselves realize that we are on the way out the exit. We're leaving. Then they may confront this and actually act out in a way that makes some sense to themselves.
And we haven't even brought in the complexity of surrounding pressures, Iran, Saudi Arabia, et cetera.
Let's talk for a minute about domestic politics and then open it up for questions and comments from those who are in the room. What does a new president have to do in order to prepare? What does an American president, a new American president, have to do in order to help the American public understand that the building blocks for a coalition government in Iraq probably are not there in strong enough way to enable a government to be put together, and that we've either got to stay there for a very long time or we've got to pull out and turn our back on a chaotic situation? What does the new president have to do?
I suspect Bernie is as uncomfortable as I am giving advice to new presidents that we don't know the name of, but I'm not sure that's the right formulation. I think if the new president was me, I wouldn't worry so much about that question. I'd worry about finding a way to make a case both to the American public and the Iraqis, here's what we're going to do. It seems fair to me, President Geiser, that we do this. I hope you agree. But we're going to do it because it's in our best interest to do it, and we've tried to do other things, and they haven't worked. What we're going to do is this. We're going to leave in the next 20 months, 20 months from today, we're going to be gone. We're going to leave as smoothly and as slowly, as carefully as we can. I like Obama's line, I confess, that we're going to be as careful and responsible in leaving as we were uncareful and irresponsible in arriving. But that's what's going to happen now. To those Americans who are worried about this, I say I'm worried about it too, but I'm not worried about it as much as I am about the damage that we're doing to ourselves by not leaving. And to you Iraqis who are worried about it, I say, well, this is your opportunity. Don't just sit there worrying about it. Do something. But do understand that there is this time level. I just made up 20 months. I don't know if there's a right number or not. But I do think that we simply have to say, this is it. We've tried our best. We failed. We screwed up. We apologize for screwing up. But we can't fix it. Only you guys can fix it. So here's your chance. And just do it. I don't think we can go farther than that.
No good options all have risks. Yeah. And your formulation, George, seemed to be either or, which is, like Bob, I don't accept either. I think there are possibly third or fourth alternatives, none of them very happy. But we're leaving out a major element. We're leaving out the regional influence in that particular area. To the degree that it is possible, it is not exclusively an American responsibility, that other countries in the area have a stake. And I must say, when I take a look down that bleak tunnel of the future, so far as the Middle East is concerned, it is a very scary scenario that emerges. A very, very scary scenario, because you have the feeling that everything is sacrificable as long as I get my point of view across. And if you're coming out of generations of ethnic intense conflict, of radicalization, Islamic radicalization at this particular point, with a destiny of an image of the Islamic place in the world. For example, there was a time when I was on a pro bono delegation, a U.S. delegation, going to the Middle East, to Israel, and to the State Department. And I was, for some reason or other, I was the media representative, you were the police, and you were the academic, let us say. I tried, when my turn came, to be the chairman, to see what could be done, and the response, the challenge was, how do we lower the level of rhetoric? It was coming out of the Y Plantation Agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And so I made some rather innocent, possibly workable suggestions about exchanging journalists, sharing radio programs, sharing the point of view, going to different schools to talk and so forth. The Palestinian side in this particular case said that was impossible. That was impossible. I don't mean to single out the Palestinian, but I do want to give you the gist of the nature of intense, calcified confrontations that last centuries. No matter what I proposed, didn't fly. Well, the next day we met with one of the leaders of the Palestinian community, very close to Arafat. We all know him, Saab Erekat. And I asked him point blank, I said, look, I'm not a diplomat. I'm on this as a journalist and so forth. I said, is your spokesman under instructions to make sure nothing happens? And he was surprised. And the vignette comes to mind, not to single out the Palestinians, but in terms of translating that sort of environment, that question, to the milieu of Iraq. How is it possible for me as a Shia to surrender a syllable of authority to the Sunnis? And how is it possible the other way around? And we Kurds have already said it's hopeless. We've created our own country up in the north. Can you take these three central composite groups, get it to work? This is not new. It's been going on in Iraq since Churchill picked up that pencil and drew a map and said, this is Iraq. And it's been assassinations, coups, and whatnot. And we know about the virtue of Saddam Hussein. And so there's a bit of a Bleaksville about what I'm suggesting and what I hope does not take place. But the gamble is, will I, as a Sunni or a Shia or as a Kurd, will I say I've got a stake in what happens, or will I remain a prisoner of antique hostilities?
Oh, it's just a question and a comment. I think It takes a very small number of armed people ready to kill to hold a whole population prisoner. And I think it's more the feelings of the Shiite or the Sunni in relation to the killings coming from the other side that will make them, whatever their aspirations to peace would be, as ordinary people, it perverts the whole problem. And it's the question of armed, de bandes armées, armed groups that are ravaging the country and making the problem absolutely insoluble. And I've heard also that the surge had had, for one of the results of the surge was to establish links with these armed groups and to create alliances so that they would keep order on their terrain. But that is very fragile.
This is, of course, right. I mean, the big success of the surge was the rise of these Sunni militias that we have paid the salaries of and helped arm, which...
It's gone to millions and millions of dollars. The last figure was what that you saw about? Was it $70 million or something?
Something like that. And the tragic fact of the level of armament in the society now is stunning. I mean, every family has an AK-47, according to one of my colleagues writing in the Washington Post. There's so many guns and so much weaponry. And this, you know, what do you use it for? That's really the issue that we're all talking about. What's worth firing the gun for? What's the benefit we're looking for? Is it just a dead member of the other group? Well, too often that's been the case so far. If there's no larger cause, then there's not much hope.
I heard Batkachi, the former foreign minister who was visiting the United States the last few days, I heard him speaking at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and he came up with what he would like, the Americans. I'd like you to go, but I'd like you to stay. That's essentially what the policy was. I'd like you to go because we have a sense of being occupied. And as somebody had indicated earlier, you're chipping away at our identity that we are a dependent country. And that's not a good idea. You're occupiers. So for that reason, you should really go. On the other hand, if you go, we'll be faced with all sorts of internal turmoil and possibly even chaos. So we ask you to stay. How long? Well, until things get quiet. So can you please go and stay at the same time? And that is not a laughable, analysis of what the situation is there. Who used the word fragile? You just used that word fragile, Bob?
She did.
You did, yeah. McCain. fragile. There's got to be an even better word than fragile to talk about how vaporized, how tissue paper thin so much of it is there. And as Bob points out, this Sunni awakening, it is a rented awakening. They're getting paid by the month to demonstrate a different kind of loyalty. And when the paychecks stop, we may just revert to clannish identity once again.
I just want to invoke a couple of thoughts on the more things change, the more they stay the same. And I'm thinking of David Halberstam's, whom both of you gentlemen know, who appeared at a Kennedy Center forum on the same subject a couple of years ago in March, I think it was.
Yeah.
And his concern, of course, was the great lying machine in Washington, which
Lying machine. Yeah, that was the phrase he used.
Right. Well, I think it's still true in terms of what we're told and what we're revealed. And so you might think about the great lying machine in Washington in honor of David Halberstam and discuss that aspect of the problem, which includes sourcing of news items and those sorts of things.
There are many tragedies of the last 8 years, and there'll be many books written about the tragedies of the last 8 years, quite a few already written. But to me personally, this is the greatest tragedy. We have lived through a period where the politically powerful people seemed genuinely to believe one of Vladimir Lenin's oldest tenets, which was that the end justifies the means. And we have seen more systematic lying in Washington, which is quite a compliment, because there's always been systematic lying in Washington, but we have seen more in this administration than ever before. Sometimes the cause on whose behalf the lying is done can be defended, at least by some people, but the general debasement of the currency of truth-telling that has occurred in modern Washington, not just in this last 7 years, but over the last 35 or 40 years, the era of the permanent campaign, the bloody ideological warfare of American politics has now been going on a long time, is really tragic for my daughters and their children. I just feel very bad about it. It's a great loss. It's easy to succumb to a nostalgic rosy rearview mirror and say things used to be much better. I don't think things were ever much better, but things were better at different times. Bernie's old friend, my colleague Murray Marder, invented the phrase the credibility gap. He invented it for Lyndon Johnson in 1966 or '67. And that may be the time that we go back to begin all this. We certainly learned to lie in Vietnam, our government did, that is to say. But this is a really grave problem, and thank goodness we still have truth tellers who stand up and say, no, that's a lie. Unfortunately, due to economic and other factors, institutions like mine and the New York Times are going to have a precarious next decade or so to see if we could survive and keep telling the truth or trying to. But this is a huge, huge societal problem.
And yet, I must say, being here at this particular time when Obama emerges as the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party for president, I feel a particularly thrilling time to be here. I haven't been in Charlottesville for some time. I've been to Monticello once before, and we came back and made sure we could go there again. If I wander in this place here, and I see these paintings on the wall, and then you go to Monticello, and then you think of American history, I must say, when you think of this group of kids who helped put this country together, it is really remarkable. I was stunned to discover that Jefferson was all of about 32 or 33 when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And I was talking to George before we got started here. To be here in Charlottesville with its slavery of once upon a time here in this part of the country, and George reminds me that it's almost 400 years since the first slaves arrived here during Jamestown, 1619, et cetera. And to be here in Charlottesville at this time, in this very complex, thinking of Jefferson and Madison and Adams and Washington, as an American, it's very, very thrilling. And if we've talked bleakly about what the forecast might be in Iraq and the challenges that exist there, and there's certainly no reason to discard it all, we may see an emergence of brilliance on the part of the Iraqis. I'm delighted to be taken by surprise. But by the same token, I can't leave this area without saying the excitement I think most of us feel that the journey, the 400-year-old journey, has come from slavery to Obama, whoever your political choice may be. The fact is that this has happened in this country. When I think of countries I've been around the world, this has got to be at a startling excitement for the entire world, that this could happen in the United States. And it reburnishes the credentials and the image of America throughout the world. Thank you.
I'd be really interested in hearing from two reporters with Vietnam experience anything that you'd like to say about news coverage of the current war, particularly in comparison with what you know about the news coverage of Vietnam.
After you, Monsieur.
I already referred to the big difference that's very striking to us, which is the total lack of freedom of movement that is so difficult for our colleagues in Iraq now. We had this incredible luxury in Vietnam. There was something called Hotel 3, which was the helicopter service for reporters.
Hotel 3,
you remember?
Yes.
You'd call up, you heard there's something interesting going on in Kinh Hoa province in the Mekong Delta, which was one of my favorites. I could literally call a young major in a public relations office on Tuesday night and say, on Thursday morning, I'd like to go down to Kinwa. Yes, sir, there'll be a helicopter at Hotel 3. Here's your wing number. And they literally lay on a helicopter for me, the 25-year-old reporter, 6-year-old reporter of the Washington Post, so I could fly down the Mekong Delta and see what was going on in Kinwa. We went everywhere. Everyone would see us. We had the rank of major, so that if we were captured by the Viet Cong, we had this ID card that said, treat this man as though he were a major. I always thought that
was a lot good that did.
But it was, you know, it was incredibly fun for us, I have to say, but it was also extremely luxurious intellectually and journalistically. There was nothing you couldn't see, almost, and nobody you couldn't talk to. Operating in Iraq today is just the opposite. It's scary. There are people out there with guns who will pull the trigger quite quickly. The number of journalists killed in Iraq is 3 or 4 times the number killed in Vietnam in a much shorter war. And it's just awful. So the kind of reporting that I used to love to do, which is to spend a few days in a place and try to figure out what the local social and political dynamic was, and so on. And was this pacification that people were bragging about something real, or was it phony, and so on? You just can't do anything like that in Iraq. So if you read carefully the stories, there are only a couple of us left, the New York Times and the Washington Post, the best examples that are really trying to keep people on the ground there. We still have four people in our bureau. The Times has 4 or 5. It's extremely expensive. We have a huge price tag on our security operation. We've hired a small private army of our own to protect the Washington Post correspondents in Iraq. But they just have none of the opportunities that we had. And even the politicians living in the green zone, we're not in the green zone. We're right next to it. But it just isn't that easy to get to people and to talk to people. We also have large staffs of local Iraqi journalists working for us. They're very helpful. But it's an opaque place to begin with, and there are vast parts of it that nobody ever gets. And you never get to interview a member of the other side, or the other sides, more accurately. One of the best stories I wrote, I say immodestly, from Saigon, was based on a day-long interview with a young North Vietnamese who had given up in Chu Hoi, it was called. He had come over to the South Vietnam and asked for refuge and begun to talk. And he was a talker and a very bright kid. And he told me an amazing story about his whole life, how he'd gotten recruited into the North Vietnamese Army, how he'd come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, how he'd been received in South Vietnam when he arrived, and so on. It was a very vivid story, which I thought really helped to explain what had happened in Vietnam and why it had happened. I've never read a story like that from Iraq. I've never seen a good interview with an Iraqi insurgent explaining how he became an insurgent, why he did, and so on. So the level of journalism is much shallower from Iraq, sadly, and we just know much less.
Curiously, Chester, where are you? There you are. Who asked the question is working on a book on the television war. The curious thing is that in both instances, both in Vietnam and in Iraq, the press started off fairly gung-ho, or it started off certainly with Iraq less critical. Now, for example, if you begin, we talked about David Halberstam. David at the outset was fairly gung-ho, but then he took a look at strategies and performances and the Arvin and the tensions and so forth, and then he wrote about the lying machine on the part of the Kennedy administration to keep the truth from being expressed. But as from the early gung-ho of the press corps, by and large in Vietnam, it then went to the heavy criticism that we're all familiar with. Criticism at the point of not calculated criticism, but reporting the truth turned out to be highly critical, so far as policy was concerned. You would then think that coming out of Vietnam, coming out of an apogee of criticalness on the part of the media, heavily skeptical, finely tuned to deception, knowing where the lies were, you would think that the press would begin the Iraqi coverage at the same altitude of suspicion. That did not happen. The press collapsed, and it was due to a triumph of strategy on the part of the Pentagon. I once wrote a piece early on for CNN when I was doing these essays on journalism. Donald Rumsfeld, I wrote, had taken the Pentagon press corps prisoner. If you go back and look at the shallowness, the softness, the mushiness of the questions, because after all, the Iraqis were going to welcome us with flowers. This was going to be shock and awe. We'd all be home by the weekend. And those questions with the performance, the panache of Donald Rumsfeld massaging the press by personal appearances every day. You've never seen an animal that is so happy and purring with delight when a high official massages a reporter. And when Rumsfeld came down and talked to the press, they were taken prisoner. And then the truth began piling up. Abu Ghraib, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and now we are where we are today. So in that sense, in Vietnam, it started gung-ho. It went to criticalness, reporting the truth, the hard truth. You would think they would stay at that altitude of acute skepticism. No, it collapsed. They were taken prisoner. Press Corps was taken prisoner, as I say, early on, and now it's risen again. So you've got that line. You, Shimada, you've got the, do you think my analysis is brilliant?
Of course I do. However, I think you've left out one important ingredient, which is the trauma of 9/11, which I think as a society we have not really absorbed very well or internalized, but it is certainly part of the explanation for what you so brilliantly described. And I wish I understood it better myself, but I think it's an important part of that.
9/11 was a kind of a pallbearer for journalistic truth for a while until it shook itself off, no question of it. But taking the press corps prisoner, Chester, that is an absolutely operative phrase, and that's what happened.
I would like to ask Mr. Cobb, of the 30 Vietnamese interlocutors on the subject of American politics who were all for McCain, what was their reason?
I don't know.
Why were the Vietnamese for McCain?
Oh, because we know him. I said, yes, but you know him quite well. You had him in prison for 5.5 years. Yes, you do know him. Well, we know him. The others are unknown quantities. At least McCain knows. And also there was something else, and this is interesting about McCain, among other things that may be interesting about McCain. In 1995, McCain was one of the leading forces with John Kerry for establishing relations with Vietnam. Was no longer North, it was Vietnam. Vietnam having been solidified into one country in 1974 with the American defeat. And the hostility persisted year after year, but it was McCain and Senator Kerry, both of whom worked very hard in the administration to bring about, Clinton administration, to bring about the establishment of diplomatic relations between the two countries. This is from a guy who was in prison 5.5 years, who was, how to put it, not very well treated. Offered freedom because his father was such a paramount official, SINCPAC commander, Pacific, and John McCain said, no, no, no. Now, just a couple of years ago, we had a visiting prime minister, Prime Minister Khai, K-H-A-I, from Vietnam, arriving in the United States. He was given a very kind of a cool, correct welcome by the White House. You remember that story, Bob? A dinner was held in his honor at the Mayflower Hotel. Outside, there was a small demonstration allowed, making sure that it was behaved, an anti-communist demonstration, placards and everything else, denouncing the dinner, denouncing everybody having anything to do with the dinner. And inside, there was the Prime Minister of Vietnam with an audience. I think the dinner might have been sponsored by a U.S.-Vietnam economic group, possibly inquiring about economic opportunities, nourishing the relation for whatever combination of reasons. And who was the introducer of Prime Minister Khai? John McCain. And so I kept thinking, I was upstairs on the stage, I essentially crashed that dinner, and looking down, listening to McCain, but in my mind, I could not put out that prison where I've been to many, many times. I was in that prison just 2 months ago. And I went up to McCain afterwards, after the Prime Minister's, I said, Senator, what a journey you have made. Prisoner, introducer, Prime Minister of Vietnam. He said, Bernie, I am the luckiest man alive, is what McCain said to me, verbatim. It was a sentence I sought to scratch into my head and remember. Open, I suppose, to a variety of interpretations, having survived, or what I like to think more, given the nature of McCain vis-a-vis Vietnam, that notwithstanding a war that was fought, notwithstanding 58,000 Americans dead and 300,000 wounded, billions, trillions wasted, millions of Vietnamese killed, that he felt done something, bring them together. Sorry. That was it.
George, if you would allow me, please, to thank the Miller Center for having this wonderful conference. Thank you, Mark, George, Governor Blyles, and everybody else, and all the participants in this. What I'd like to make a comment is, during lunchtime, we were talking about history, about we are still reliving the Civil War, and oftentimes. And the Iraqis are similarly living past injustices. Brings to mind a story of a journalist who wanted to go to see the Abdullah House. And he got into the taxi cab and asked the driver to go to the Abdullah House. After driving a little bit, he said, I can't take you there. And the journalist said, why not? He said, oh, they killed one of my uncles. He said, when did that happen? He said, in 1824. On this, I'd just like to thank the Miller Center. Thank you.
Yes, Mark. Yes, I was going to thank Mark, too. I suppose that he's been thanked so often there.
We're going to let Mark have the last word.
Well, but before he gets the last word, I want to have a pre-last word, as it were. And that is really to thank you for bringing this conference together. I don't normally come to these things because it's for you scholars who parse every single syllable and every scrap of history. And I'm much more metabolistically journalistic, which is quite a different world and a totally different culture. But I must say it's been quite extraordinary and nourishing to catch all this wisdom here by the whiz kids, your scholars, and you helped. You're the impresario, and I thank you very much for that.
It is my pleasure, and especially to be able to end our time with a captivating, insightful, sobering, but I would also say uplifting panel in the end is greatly appreciated and is the perfect way, I think, to close this conference on the politics of troop withdrawal. I also want to thank the Miller Center more broadly for all of its support in making this happen. To all of our extraordinary panelists and moderators for your time and energy, effort, and to all the staff here at the Miller Center who did all the things that needed to go right to make this happen, and to you, the audience, who has spent 2 days with us, very full 2 days of heavy analysis and storytelling and some extraordinary moments, I think, in the give and take that we will all carry back and will hopefully contribute to our enterprise, as I mentioned at the beginning, the scholarly enterprise, but also more broadly to the public debate about where we go from here as a nation. Thank you very much.